On this week's Please Explain, we're going to take a trip to the ocean floor for a look at some of the creatures that live there, like cuttlefish, squid, octopuses, sea stars, and seahorses. Joining us are Roger Hanlon, senior scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and Ellen Prager, formerly the chief scientist at Aquarius Reef Base in Florida, author of Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, which is published by Chicago University Press. Hello and welcome to our show.
Hello, Leonard. Great to be here. Thank you.
Hi. Here from a warm Miami.
You've escaped the rains. We are taking listener calls, by the way, at 646-829-3985. In case you have a question, you give us a call or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And Ellen, Hurricane Irene is heading for the eastern seaboard, and we know that hurricanes can do a lot of damage to land. But do storms like this impact life underwater on the ocean floor where these creatures live?
Well, they can because the habitats where they live can be impacted. Hurricanes can cause surge under the sea, and you can get damage to coral reefs, seagrass beds. So certainly, particularly in the coastal zone, hurricanes can really impact marine life.
Let's look at some of these creatures. Roger, maybe we should take octopus and squids first. What are the characteristics of cephalopods? It's called cephalopods?
Cephalopods, we generally say.
Okay.
And it's very strange. The name gives away what they are. They have their head on their foot. So it's a mollusk related to an oyster, believe it or not. But it's a rather elegant animal in terms of having a very large brain and extremely good vision and very complex behavior, especially for an invertebrate animal.
Do they all have eight legs?
They all have eight appendages. We generally call them arms, and then the squids and the cuttlefish have two long tentacles. So some of them have 10, and all of them have at least 8.
And can you explain the suckers?
The suckers are really important to these animals. Every arm is lined by suckers, and the suckers are what do all the sensing of chemical and taste and touch. They manipulate objects. They help the animals feed and groom. And the suckers are really like our fingers. They really do a lot of the work that the octopus carries out.
So, Ellen, do they hunt?
Oh, they hunt in many different ways. And I have to say, when I wrote this book, I had a wonderful time talking with Roger, and he just wowed me with all the stories about not only do they hunt, how they hunt, and some of their defensive capabilities. So I don't want to steal his thunder, because Roger really is the expert on this.
So how do they hunt, and what do they eat, Roger?
They like to eat crustaceans and fishes, crustaceans being crabs and shrimp and those sorts of things. And as Ellen alluded momentarily ago, they use their camouflage to stalk their prey. They also use their camouflage to elude their predators. And because they're soft-bodied and almost everything in the ocean eats an octopus or a cuttlefish or a squid, then they have to have this really sophisticated camouflage against the best and most diverse visual predators on the planet, including diving porpoises, diving birds, all kinds of groupers and snappers and bluefish, and you name it. Almost all of those predators out there are eating these animals, so they've got great camo.
So these cephalopods can camouflage themselves. Can they all do it, or is it just squid and octopus?
They can all do it. I would say the ones that may not do too much camouflage are the extremely deep sea animals, but even they have their special kind of camo with bioluminescence. But all of the animals that we see in the shallower and nearshore areas of the ocean all do this beautiful, diverse, and very fast camouflage changing.
And we posted a video on our website that you've taken. It shows an octopus in its natural habitat. Can you describe what it shows? And by the way, before you do, I encourage everyone who's listening to watch it when you get a chance, because it's incredible.
Well, it starts out very boring, which is good, because all you see is a rock with some algae on it out in a sand plain on the backside of a coral reef. And all of a sudden, you see this bright white octopus. It turns out was one-third of that rock was a live octopus. And its camouflage was so good, you didn't see it. And suddenly, it goes bright white with a high-contrast, dark eye that you can't miss, and then it inks in the face of the camera and swims off. And so it's visually startling, and then as you play it in reverse in slow motion, you see the details of what happens when it's fully conspicuous, and then it just disappears right in front of your eyes as it blends into the background.
Now, you said it inks in the direction of the camera. Is that because it saw the camera as a potential enemy?
Exactly, and I was the enemy because I was approaching the animal too closely, and it was reacting. So the primary defense of these soft-bodied animals is to be camouflaged so they don't get detected or recognized as food. And the second defense, when they realize that the predator is too close, they go to Plan B. Plan B is look bright and white to startle or threaten the approaching predator, ink in its face, and that obscures the vision and has a bad chemical taste, and then the animal jets away and goes back to other tricks.
And they do it very fast, but how can they do that? They have a very distinctive look normally, and then suddenly an octopus with its suckers and all of its arms suddenly becomes something that looks very much like algae.
Yes, and this is the main theme of our research, is trying to understand how camouflage works, and it's all about visual perception. Now, it's pretty easy to fool human vision, believe it or not. Many of the animals that are eating these soft-bodied octopuses have many visual capabilities we don't see. Some of them see color better than we do. Some of them see polarized light. Some see ultraviolet light. Many of them can see at night, and humans can't do any of those. So it's really this visual trickery that's going on to deceive the visual system that's looking at it. In this case, it's many visual systems.
Including texture.
Yeah, the three-dimensional texture of the skin is changing as well, so they can go from very smooth skin to highly rugose, or we say papillate skin. It's three-dimensional texture, and you can imagine that's extremely important because otherwise you would detect the edges of the animal looking smooth versus what they're on has rough edges, and then it would stand out. So they can even look at the background, and they can imitate the three-dimensionality of the objects that they're sitting near.
Incredible. Roger Hanlon is senior scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Ellen Prager is the author of Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, which is published by Chicago University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and a reminder, you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or give us a call at 646-829-3985. Ellen, how do squid and octopuses swim?
Well, as Roger said, they're actually jet-propelled most of the time. They can, they basically put water into their mantle, and then they release it out what's called a siphon, and it's like jet-propelled. But if you see them in the water, they can do all sorts of things. They can hover slowly. They can jet-propel, as you said. They can basically almost crawl over the bottom. They're incredibly versatile, and so you can say they swim this way and then see them doing something else.
Well, cuttlefish seem to scuttle or skim across the bottom of the ocean. Are they propelling themselves in the same way?
Well, they can be, but, I mean, I've actually seen them. Roger, you've probably seen this in person, but I've seen them obviously walking on their arms like they're crawling for the octopus.
Mm-hmm.
One
thing I might add, Ellen, is that the cuttlefish are a little unusual because they have a buoyancy mechanism built into their body, so they can stay neutrally buoyant like a diver does. So they can sort of hover against the bottom, whereas a squid and an octopus, they're negative and they sink to the bottom. So they do have a unique capability.
Well, cuttlefish and squid seem to be very closely related, are they?
They are closely related, except for this buoyancy mechanism that the cuttlefish have evolved and the squids have not. It makes a big difference in the energy game because a squid has to swim all day long just to stay in one position and not descend to the bottom. A cuttlefish just pumps little gas into this little cuttle bone, which many of your readers or listeners may have seen in parakeet cages. And they just pump gas in and out of that, and they regulate their buoyancy. So it's a real very cool mechanism.
They don't have an outer shell like many of the other creatures on the seafloor. Are they food for other marine animals?
It's true. They've got rid of that shell for this elaborate skin, and they are food for just about everything, including humans. They're very tasty.
And what about nautiluses? They do have a shell, But aren't they in the same family?
Interesting question. The nautiluses are the most ancient living representatives of the cephalopods. They've been around for many millions of years, basically unchanged. And that's a very sophisticated shell. And they also are considered to be nature's first scuba tank in the sense that they pump gas into that shell to regulate their buoyancy. But when they get into an oxygen-depleted layer, they also use that gas to respire. So even though it's a somewhat simple animal, very successful plan and still around.
Ellen, Roger mentioned bioluminescence, mm-hmm. I guess it is.
Yes.
This is the ability for them to light up. How does that work?
It turns out in the ocean, there are some people that believe that almost 90% of marine life can biologically produce light, and that's what we're talking about.
Some, for what reason? They don't need the light to like a headlight on a car.
Well, there's a lot of different reasons you could use light underwater. You could use it to lure in prey. You could use it as a defensive mechanism to startle a predator. It turns out it actually has quite a few uses. So some people think it's like an alarm, and we also think some animals use it to communicate to one another, particularly in the darker parts of the ocean. So this is an area of very active research right now in how many creatures produce light, how do they do it, and what are they doing with it.
It was also mentioned that octopuses have large brains. Does that mean that they're intelligent or they just have large brains?
Oh, that's a good one. This is a great question for Roger. I'm sure you've had experience with trying to keep them in tanks.
Yes, Leonard, they do have relatively enormous brains. They have 34, 35 lobes of the brain, and their brain to body weight is very high, comparable to birds and a lot of animals that we're more familiar with. So, yes, this is a very brainy mollusk, there's no question about it. And they're capable of short-term and long-term memory, just like we are. So it's a pretty sophisticated brain that produces all these diverse behaviors, and part of the reason is that they're living in the most active parts of the ocean, like coral reefs, places where there are some very, very good predators, some very smart animals that they have to survive in conjunction with. So yes, these are definitely the brainy, intelligent invertebrates.
Now, we mentioned earlier that octopus and cuttlefish can camouflage themselves, like sand, gravel, algae. But can they do other things? Would they look like a checkerboard, or if you put them on top of polka dots or plaid, could they do that?
Well, we do those sorts of experiments here, and the answer is that these animals can go to any visual background, and within half of a second, they can accomplish really superb camouflage. So how they do that is really driving our research program. The bottom line is that there are one or two secrets that we think we've discovered, and that is, if I ask you or your listeners how many camouflage patterns there are in an octopus, or more generally, how many camouflage patterns are there on the planet for any animal, we always thought the number was very high, but by studying this very thoroughly for several decades, we think the answer may be just three or four basic camouflage pattern types, and with a lot of variation in each one. But this means that they can look around them and very quickly just pick up one cue, one visual cue to turn on camouflage pattern A versus B, and that accounts for the speed. So, yes, they can go anywhere, and I'll remind the listeners that these are the most visually rich environments on the planet, much more so than a tropical rainforest. So they're working under the toughest circumstances, let us say.
Amy from Manhattan left this comment. When an octopus or other cephalopod imitates a texture, is the skin really taking on that texture, or is it creating an optical illusion? And she also wants to know about starfish, and we'll get to that in a little while.
Yes, excellent question. And we do know that the animals are looking at the background, and they're implementing the change in their skin, and it is a physical three-dimensional change in the skin. It's not strictly or solely an optical illusion. But she leads to a good point, Amy does, because the cuttlefish has smooth, sort of rigid body, and they do create the illusion of three-dimensionality by the way they form the patterns in their skin, even though they may not change the three-dimensional texture. So I guess the answer is C, all of the above. They can do both.
Ellen, do you know if these abilities to camouflage themselves have any applications for humans?
Well, that, you know, there's a really good reason why Roger and other scientists are studying cephalopods and other marine animals. You know, we are learning so much from these organisms in terms of visual systems, biochemistry, and, you know, imagine if we could come up with the same sort of sensing capabilities that the octopus and cuttlefish have and use it in other ways. So in biotechnology, in biomedical models, huge number of applications.
My guests are Ellen Prager, formerly the chief scientist at Aquarius Reef Base in Florida, author of Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, which is published by Chicago University Press, and Roger Hanlon, senior scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And we are back with Please Explain Today, a look at sea creatures, the ones that live on the bottom of the ocean, with Roger Hanlon, a senior scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and Ellen Prager, who has written a book called Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime. It's published by Chicago University Press. Starfish have the ability to regenerate limbs. Do cephalopods also have that ability?
Yes, they do. If an octopus has an arm bitten off by an eel, and that happens quite frequently, then they can regenerate that arm. However, the octopus is such a short-lived animal, it only lives about a year, that usually the whole arm doesn't regenerate back. But yes, much like a starfish, the cephalopods can also regenerate arms.
And I'm sure we've been researching that process. Do we understand how it works?
Short answer is no, I'm afraid. But there is a new research program starting here on regenerative biology, and maybe we'll be able to approach that question in the near future.
Aren't dolphins also able to heal themselves very quickly after they've been attacked by a shark?
Well, I don't really know. Ellen, do you have any background on that?
I don't know about that. I think that they do have healing capabilities, but I'm not sure if it's abnormally fast. I will say this whole idea of regeneration under the sea is really fascinating. You know, starfish not only can regenerate arm, if an arm breaks off with part of their central disc, they can actually regenerate their whole bodies.
Wow.
Sea cucumbers can regenerate their internal organs. So there's a lot many creatures in the ocean who have very strong healing abilities and regeneration capabilities, and it's exciting to hear that MBL has this new program because, again, imagine what we could do if we could learn how they do this.
Now, we're calling them starfish. Are they the same things as sea stars?
Same thing. It's the newer, I would say the modern term is sea star, but it's the same thing that everybody used to call starfish.
Now, Roger, you mentioned that octopus live fairly brief lives, so that means they have to mature very young. Do they have any particular mating rituals?
They have an amazingly complicated sex life, believe it or not. These animals form pairs, and the males compete over the females, and the females have some very coy and sophisticated reactions to test the males, and it's just amazing that you would find such complexity in this animal group, and that goes for the squids and the cuttlefish as well.
Let's take a call. We go now to Richard from Bayside, Queens. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon. My question involves octopodes generally live 1 to 2 years. They mate, and then they die, and squid are similar. If, say, an octopus, common octopus, could live, say, 10 years and gather all the knowledge and experience that it would accumulate over 10 years, and then it would reproduce and then die, would these animals perhaps become more intelligent than they seem to be at this point?
That's an interesting question, and one would have to presume the answer is more in the direction of yes than no, because of their very well-developed long-term memory, one would assume that they can accumulate that knowledge over a longer period. So it's really strange that such a short-lived animal develops such a big brain. In most of nature, it's just the opposite. So it's a very unusual animal group, and that's a viable idea.
Thank you for calling us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, Ellen, we've heard of the elusive giant squid. Do we know if they really exist?
Well, we know they exist. There have been quite a few that have actually washed up dead on beaches, or people have caught them in trawl nets. The big thing is we very rarely have ever seen one alive.
Now, that's weird, because if they're big, don't you think they'd be easy to spot?
Well, but they live fairly deep. They could be fast. There's no, you know, they don't have a real reason to come up to the surface. And the truth is, our capabilities of seeing and exploring deep in the sea are pretty limited.
How big do they grow to?
Well, that's a little bit of controversy because, again, you know, the only ones we've gotten are the ones that sort of end up dead. I don't know, Roger. What's your opinion? What do you think? How big do you think they can get?
Well, we know from the specimens that have been collected that they can weigh several hundred pounds commonly, and they've got a very thick body. It might be 3 meters, 10 or 12 feet long, and very broad. And then they have these enormously long tentacles that are maybe three times the length of the body. I think the largest one that's been found is close to 1,000 pounds. That's
Wow.
half a ton. So that's a lot of calamari.
And why are they so rare? Do we know about their mating practices? Well, obviously, we don't see them underwater.
Yeah, well, they could. In fact, it's not that they may not be rare. It's just we live in a very different part of the planet than they do, and so we don't see them.
Yeah, Ellen's right. They live roughly from 2,000 to 5,000 feet deep, and so it's very hard to sample that area. A colleague, Dr. Kubadera in Japan, has managed to get the first film of live giant squid about 4 years ago, and then actually had deployed this gear that caught one, and they brought it to the surface and captured the very first live Architeuthis. That's the name of the giant squid. And that was a valuable catch because now the skin and the eyes and many of the organs are being studied by scientists like him and ourselves and others, and we're beginning to put some fact to the fiction to this, you know, phenomenal animal.
It's because in the past it felt kind of like Yeti or something like that. But we have no idea how long they live because we really haven't been able to watch them develop.
You know what? There's a colleague who has gotten the status cyst, which is a little thing in the inner ear that generally records how long a squid lives. And he looked at the statolith rings. It's kind of like rings on a tree, aging it. And he counted them. And it was only about a few hundred, and since these are usually a ring per day, the indication was that even some of these very large squids are growing very rapidly, perhaps only living a few years.
That's really amazing about how fast they must grow to obtain that size so quickly.
My guests are Ellen Prager and Roger Hanlon. We're talking about the creatures that live on the bottom of the sea on today's Please Explain It, and we invite your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Ellen, can you tell us about vampire squid? How did they get that name?
Well, vampire squid, they're sort of a cross between an octopus, a cuttlefish, and a squid. They live in sort of the midwater to deeper parts of the ocean. Very odd organism. I guess, Roger, say they look like a sort of a dark football-shaped creature, more like an octopus in my mind than a squid. What do you think?
I think they look like an alien. honestly, they've been on television. Some of our colleagues have gotten beautiful images of them, and they don't look like a typical cephalopod, and they have this deep red skin, and they just look sort of devilish and vampire-like, and that accounts for the common name, really.
But they don't suck anyone's blood.
No.
Not that anyone's discovered
yet. You don't have to worry about them swimming, you know, swimming up and grabbing you. None of that.
Now, you mentioned coral. We don't normally think of coral as a sea creature. Are they considered animals?
They are. Actually, most corals are colonies of small animals we call coral polyps, which you can think of them as simple stomachs surrounded by a ring of tentacles. But most corals, not all, but almost all corals are colonies of these creatures that live together.
How do they reproduce?
They have several different ways of reproducing. Some of them can actually just produce buds or coral clones. Others of them reproduce sexually, either by releasing sperm and eggs into the water where they mix, or they can brood their eggs and then release sort of a miniature coral almost.
So we're talking about something that's barely more than a stomach and a little stuff around it that actually still releases sperm?
That's correct. Amazing. And many corals do what we call mass spawning on reefs, where somehow they, one time a year, at one particular sort of point in time, they, all the corals on a reef of a specific species, will release their eggs and sperm at the same time.
So there are male and female corals?
Well, not exactly. They get lost. Some of the corals release a packet of egg and sperm together, and some of the corals release egg and sperm separately.
The reason I...
Then,
yeah, go ahead.
No, and then what happens is they float up, the fat or the lipids in the eggs causes them to float up to the surface where they all mix, and some of the eggs get fertilized by sperms from other coral heads.
So there's complications about sexuality in the deep sea, not just with coral, also seahorses, which we have talked about in the past on this show. There's a photograph in your book of a seahorse that blends into a red background. Do they also camouflage themselves?
They can. They sort of have color-changing plates on their skin. But I will tell you, from the research for this book, I discovered that there are amazing strategies in the ocean for not only attracting mate, like what Roger was talking about with the cuttlefish, but also to reproduce and basically produce offspring and protect them, even in some cases. So there's all sorts of strange things going on in the ocean, I have to say.
Well, seahorses are famous because the male carries the young, don't
right.
they? Not that, the female.
That's correct. The male carry the eggs. And there's a jawfish, which actually the males incubate the eggs in its mouth. And they will sort of brood the eggs, brood in the mouth, and they'll spit them out periodically, aerate them, and then suck them in until they're born.
Is that why they're called jawfish?
It is. They also use their jaws like bulldozers to dig out burrows and sort of do home maintenance. But that is why they're called jawfish.
Now, we've heard about corals being endangered. The reefs are deteriorating because of pollution in the sea. Have these other creatures also been affected?
Well, let me say that the coral reefs are under several threats. Probably the biggest one right now is from climate change, and not only increasing seawater temperatures, but the changing pH of the ocean. Pollution is just one problem. They are under numerous threats that are causing them to be at risk. But certainly those things also impact other marine life, as does overfishing.
So, but I'm wondering about overfishing in terms of some of the fish that we see that are brightly covered, anyone who's been snorkeling, who's visited an aquarium,
right.
knows that most tropical fish are brightly colored, the opposite of camouflage. Does that
right.
make them more vulnerable, or are they camouflaging themselves in a different way?
Well, you know, it depends who you're saying vulnerable to. To humans, it doesn't matter. I mean, if you go snorkeling on most reefs around the world today, there are very few large fish because they've been overfished. So that's a real problem. The coloration on reef fish, though, some of that is not so much camouflage, or maybe camouflage in plain sight. Some of it's a warning sign of not to eat. Some of them use coloration to confuse predators. So they use them for different reasons.
Danielle left this comment on our show page. What happened to all the starfish? When I was a child, they were all over the beach jetties. Now I never see them on the Jersey Shore.
Well, it could be a number of things. It could be a changing ecosystem where they, you know, we just might not have that many or abundance of sea stars anymore. It could also be that they were collected out.
Mm-hmm.
I am somebody who is very much against, if you go to these shops where you have dried seahorses or starfish or, you know, things that they've actually ripped from the sea, people should not buy those.
We have to end this. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but it's been a lot of fun talking about these various creatures. I'm still trying to figure out how I can camouflage myself. Alan Prager is formerly the chief scientist at Aquarius Reef Base in Florida and the author of Sex, Drugs, and Sea Slime, which is published by Chicago University Press. Roger Hanlon is senior scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Thanks so much. Good luck, Roger, with your research.
Thanks, Ellen. Take care.
Since 9/11, the FBI has made counterterrorism a top priority. On Monday's show, we'll look at the agency's controversial use of informants and whether they're steering people to plan terror attacks. And then Anthony Bourdain joins us for our latest installment of our book club, and we will be taking your calls and comments about that book, Medium Raw. Also, Alex Shakar talks about his new novel, Luminarium, and we will look at how our beliefs are born, formed, reinforced, challenged, changed, and extinguished. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Julia Corcoran, Stephen Valentino, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Keith Carney, Russell Jacobs, Sarah Waltuck, and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.